You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are in our final week discussing Soji Shimada's The Tokyo Zodiac Murders, a classic murder mystery by a man who has come to be known as the god of mystery novels. Herds.
Flex. I don't know. What do you want me to say?
This is a difficult one to talk about, Hertz. Because obviously, and we'll get into this at the end of the show, I'm very chuffed that I was right about many things.
Oh, come on. Most things. There are a couple of details you missed. But yeah, we'll get into that.
There's one
particularly glaring issue that I'm shocked that you missed, and I'm a little embarrassed.
Heartbroken
so
that
we'll,
I missed
we'll talk about that when we get the points. But
I don't know how I feel about the end of this novel.
You didn't love it with all of your heart?
It's kind of too golden age for me.
Oh, come on.
I think the problem is, it feels like there's a separation between the puzzle elements and the character elements of this novel that makes sense to me, and I understand analytically why Soji Shimada did, but it means that it still pales in comparison to the authors that he has inspired who have now managed to integrate those things, such as Keigo Higashino, such as the author who was banned from the show.
Who we will never speak about.
Never speak of.
Never again. Never. Future tense.
And, you know, it's not to say that I dislike this novel. I love this
Good.
Novel. It is
10 out of 10.
Phenomenal. It's just that its flaws are so apparent because Soji Shimada has been so influential that so many people have had the opportunity to improve on what he's done. Yeah.
I don't feel like they're flaws to me. I don't look at this and say, oh, look at all these things that are wrong with it. I mean, sure, you could argue that the Devotion of Suspect X is a better job of intertwining, you know, the character of the culprit and the accomplice and all that, you know, all that stuff in with the actual methodology of the crime itself. But I don't know. I can set more of an evolution than I would like, oh, they were fixing flaws in the design of the story. Yeah. Like,
No. It's more to say that coming back to this novel with this enormous gravitas to its reputation, I think I overprepared my expectations. I think that's kind of the root of the problem there.
When I read this through this for myself, I find it very quaint, and I absolutely love the way that the author here closes out the book. I think that, like, as we say, we find out, you know, who the killer is and how they did it. And there's this whole epilogue chapter called The Voice of Azoth.
Yes.
Which is basically just a confession. It is a confession letter, one might even call it.
And that's really great because the novel begins with this letter from the supposed culprit and ends with the letter from the actual culprit.
And it, of course, is the letter from crazy painter man who wants to create Azoth, and then from the creation Azoth himself or itself, which is of course only created after the murder trick or the astrological, the magic that has been performed. And the way that Soji Shimada actually, you know, lines up these two halves of the story to create something that's really, really special and different, I think is fantastic, especially if we contrast it with, you know, a clinically aligned mystery, especially those by Sherlock Holmes, which the story goes out of the way to kind of not necessarily make fun of, but to criticize, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think I was saying last week on the show that one of the difficulties with this book is that it is so good that critiquing it sounds like I'm really digging into it because I have to be so nitpicky to find anything that I dislike about it.
Garbage.
As overall, it's just, it's phenomenally strong. I love the author's note right before we switch over to, you know, the breakdown scene that we would expect from any murder mystery novel, where Soji Shimada concludes by saying, have you figured out which type of magic Taiko Sudo has used?
Yeah, because I mean, the whole point is, and we'll definitely talk more about this in part three, but the whole point is that Kiyoshi is, you know, not exposing the culprit in such a direct way because they're like respecting them by allowing them to actually come forward and explain everything themselves. And it all is kind of ingrained in this idea that the culprit isn't just there to provide us with a mystery.
I think the thing that worked especially well for me about that is the way that it frames Koizumi's holiday in a different light, because obviously there was that subtext to Koizumi's trip where he's barging in on people's lives and basically asking them if they committed murder, which is just kind of messed up.
Yep.
And that, as I said last week, fell a bit flat for me, but with the delivery of this epilogue, it really hammers home.
It's kind of the point, right?
That, you know, it's all about who shows up for the criminal in the end.
Who shows up, and it, like, we say on the show, you know, that the important things are the who, how, and why of, like, why the criminal does the crime. But it's also important to look at the who, how, and why of the detective.
Yes.
Like, why are they pursuing the truth, and what methods do they use, And in the best mystery novels, I feel that characters who are acting rightly and justly and in line with the morals of the story are rewarded, because that's just how storytelling works. That's not just murder mystery. That's all stories. But the thing that that Soji Shimada is pointing out here is that it is important for the detectives in our murder mysteries to be right and just and to be good people who deserve to find the truth, right?
And it's really interesting how, having not felt like a deconstruction the whole way through, this epilogue makes it feel very deconstructive.
It does, yeah.
And I think that there's something really to be said for how non-clinical a very clinical deconstruction feels. Mm-hmm. That is an achievement.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that's really interesting to me looking at Koizumi and Kiyoshi as a detective duo is that so often it's the Watson's perspective being the lens of the normal person into a detective who is just so unfathomably powerful.
Kind of a sociopath a lot of the time, right?
And in this case, neither of them is a sociopath. They're both actually kind of on each other's level. They just have different approaches.
Yeah. I do want to bring it back to Act 3, actually, because as much as I make fun of Kazumi for his absolute waste of an Act 3 and his holiday, like, Kiyoshi doesn't get anywhere either. We just have a waste of a chapter to show, you know, this 40-year gap really is driving a wedge into the investigation, and we're emphasizing that that gap in time is what's causing the problem, and that gap in perspective, rather than being any specific concrete action from the other side of the chessboard.
Yeah, it's almost a metaphor in itself for the separation from the detective and the culprit.
Yes, it is.
Because that's kind of the key piece that has to come together to solve any murder mystery. Mm. And I also particularly like in there that we essentially have the police procedural trick where they're sat together and they're like, goodness, we can't figure out anything. And then someone says something completely innocuous and they just go, the thing, thing.
It's like putting too much air in a balloon. It bursts. Oh, I get it now. We can go and solve the problem.
It is the worst crime procedural trope, but Soji Shimada earns it with a vengeance here.
You're absolutely correct. It is a very simple kind of solution. And I mean, we've read the interview between Soji Shimada and Craig Sisseton, where he talks about how there was a very specific real life case where some trick was played. And that trick is obviously this trick with the bills, right?
Yeah.
That there was probably a criminal ring who were, you know, taking $100 bills and stitching a little bit off and making a 21st.
Yeah, it was also really genius of Soji Shimada to tie a case like that to something so mystical and astrological.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, like, to think, you know, the maths problem is, like I said last week, of cutting up the chocolate or dividing up the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to say, well, what if we just lopped the parts out of people's bodies and stuck them back together?
Yeah.
Like, it just, it immediately clicks in your head because it's so quintessentially murder mystery, but the execution is flawless.
Yeah, like the best murder mysteries are ingrained in some real world kind of fact and reality, and something that is genuinely, not reality, but something that is interesting in real life.
Yes.
Like one aspect that's in a lot of murder mysteries that we like is how murder actually affects the people involved in the case who were not killed. Maybe the people who are suspected but are not actually guilty.
Well,
their lives are affected, you know, sort of thing.
That just drags us back around to the point about the detectives being human, and that's totally exactly the same thing. Your detective has to feel grounded in the same way that your case does. And I think that that's one thing that Soji Shimada has done an excellent example of, making something so unfathomably far-fetched but also entirely believable.
It makes sense,
It's such an exquisite balance.
Everything just fits.
All right.
It's perfect.
Now, Herds, let's wrap up this discussion. Coming up at the end of the show today, we are going to be breaking down this crime piece by piece, pun intended. This is Flex and Herds. We're discussing the last two acts of Soji Shimada's The Tokyo Zodiac Murders. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds, having a sit-down chat with Associate Professor Rebecca Suda, expert on modern Japanese literature with Sydney University, and particularly has an upcoming talk with the Japan Foundation looking at the history of 1980s and 1990s Japanese literature. And we thought, given that we're covering Soji Shimada's The Tokyo Zodiac Murders, that was the perfect conversation to have. So, Rebecca, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Rebecca, I hear that you're going to be a speaker at the upcoming Read Japan Talk series with the Japan Foundation on March 18th. Could you tell me a bit about why you've jumped at the chance to be a part of this event, Rebecca?
Thank you. Well, actually, I had jumped at the chance of doing this about a year ago. And so it's part of a three-part lecture series on Japanese literature of so the post-war period. So starting from the 60s, and then I'm doing the 80s and 90s, and then there will be another one also on more recent, so the new millennium. Yeah, the idea is sort of to give readers. So we're talking about primarily works that are translated into English so that anyone can then read the works that we talk about. And to, yeah, just sort of make readers familiar with or give a bit more context, give a bit more knowledge about what is Japanese literature that is available in English translation.
Yeah, I mean, we're currently in the middle of a deep dive into Japanese crime fiction here on our show, our home turf. And one thing that we've noticed is how few authors that we'd love to interrogate have been translated into English. How do events like these help bridge that cultural divide when there's, you know, such a barrier for some people who, you know, maybe don't know a lick of Japanese?
Yeah, well, I guess one thing that they hope to encourage is also for people to start learning Japanese so that they can read the originals. But that's a long journey, I understand. But the other thing that I think Japan Foundation tries to do with this is also to sort of create the ground for more translations to come. So, you know, the more works become popular with readers, the more publishers are likely to also sponsor the translation of other works. So it's kind of a sort of virtuous circle, I guess.
Yeah. So the novel that we're covering on the show right now, The Tokyo Zodiac Murders by Soji Shimada, spends a lot of time, arguably too much, exploring the sights, sounds, and the romantic history of particularly Kyoto in Japan. Is this sort of indulgent, flourishy writing showing the romance and the beauty of the cities of Japan typical of the 1980s, or was Soji Shimada out on a limb?
I mean, it's a bit unusual, but it's interesting in the novel because it is not set in Kyoto, right? It has a part that where they move to Kyoto. And it's true that probably in literature of the 1980s in Japan, you would find a lot more sort of urban, super contemporary settings like Kyoto, like Tokyo skyscrapers and so forth. And I think I think that's meant in the novel maybe to sound unusual, to seem like sort of the old Japan that would be exotic to Japanese people just as much as it is exotic to foreigners.
Kind of hearkening back, I guess, to some of the more artistic works that Soji Shimada seems to reference in the way that he frames it in this very kind of painterly style he describes.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've actually reread the novel for this, and I was thinking about this in particular, the narrator. The scene that is towards the end, where he is asked by the other guy to go to I can't remember what it's called in English, the Street of Philosophers or Philosopher's Road. Or
The Philosopher's Walk, it's called in the translation I have.
Philosopher's Walk, that's right. That's a Tetsugaku no Michi. And he doesn't know what that is. In Kyoto, that's like really famous. Anybody who's been to Kyoto would know what that means. And I think it's really done a bit on purpose that, you know, the character is such a, you know, not a Kyoto person that he finds the name strange and he has to ask for directions and so forth.
He has that reaction to, I think, every landmark in the city. Yeah. When they travel over the bridge, the moon bridge, where you can, you know, see... if you look down, it's as though the moon is being crossed over by the bridge. He doesn't know what that is. He's familiar with like the Imperial Palace and the universities, but all of the more romantic and more academic, I guess, sides of Kyoto, the artsy places, I guess you might say, he's not really familiar with. And I guess that's partly just to give the audience a good place to insert themselves. But it really is a strange choice. If I were in Japan, I'm familiar with the stories of Kyoto, and somebody just doesn't know anything. You know, they're a country bumpkin, effectively.
Well, but more than a country bumpkin, I think he is a contemporary urban Japanese person, you see. So he would be familiar with, you know, Shibuya Crossing, but not the, you know, the temples of Kyoto, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Now, I understand, Rebecca, you have extensive experience studying metafictional texts, in particular the works of contemporary Japanese writer Murakami Haruki. Now, where do you draw the line, Rebecca, between clever narrative device and a true metafictional text?
That's a murder mystery question for the
ages. It absolutely is. I'm going to challenge you here, see if you can give me a straight answer.
Of course, I can't give you a straight answer. that would defeat the point. I mean, what kind of, I don't know. What is your definition of a true mental fiction?
Well, I think approaching it from the murder mystery lens, so much murder mystery references other murder mystery. Mm-hmm. There's points in the Tokyo Zodiac Murders where they're referring to all of the classic detectives of old. So there's all of this great, you know, metafictional referential stuff. And I guess that's where I draw that line, where the story kind of engages actively with its own genre, as opposed to merely referencing its own genre.
Yeah, I would agree with that. At the point where a novel crosses over into, if you can get hints as to the solution of the murder mystery by being familiar with specific aspects of the genre, like the names of characters, or a particular story that the novel just keeps referencing over and over, you know, that's when it becomes metafictional to me. That's kind of where I draw the line.
But Murakami Haruki is a bit like that as well. There's one example which is quite similar and even a bit sort of bolder or more unnerving of the something that is in the Tokyo Zodiac Murders as well, which is the thing where at the end
the author's notes towards the end
challenges the reader to solve the mystery because they have all the the parts.
Taunts.
Well, there's a novel by Murakami where he kind of did something like that and then ended up doing something very different, which is The Wind Up Bird Chronicle, which in Japanese came out in 3 volumes. And initially it came out in 2 volumes and it ends at that point. And in theory, he was going to just leave it at that. So leave the reader with all the clues and not reveal the solution.
Not that we would be familiar with any particular text that has that twist. But.
No, none whatsoever. There's a book we've banned from the show that did much the same thing.
Yeah.
And the only reason we've banned it from the show is just because we love it so dearly that we don't want to fill the show with just referring to it. Yeah, and I guess the other example that I wanted to ask about was you had a book that came out last year, Two World Literature, Kazuo Ishiguro's early novels. And when I was looking up Kazuo Ishiguro, the one thing that really interested me is the way that because he, I guess, began writing after going through school in the UK and kind of started to build that gap of, texts between Japan and England, had a bunch of really weird stories about him, you know, sending other people to stand in for him at authors' events and all those sorts of things. So what are some of the characters in fiction that you've studied that are really worth checking out if people want to get a kind of crash course in Japanese texts of those times? You know, is it Murakami Haruki and Kazuo Ishiguro? Who else should people be looking for?
If you're focusing on detective fiction, however, I have 2 favorites that I would recommend. One started in the 80s and it's Miyuki Miyabe. And the other is maybe already looked at, I don't know, is Natsuo Kirino.
More fodder for the world tour later this year, Herds, I suppose.
Too much. We need to leave Japan at some point, but like I am loving my time.
It's good.
You know, with the koi ponds and the cherry blossoms and the murder. It's thoroughly entertaining to me.
Alrighty, yeah. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much.
If you are curious in checking out Rebecca's talks along with the Japan Foundation, we will have links up on the podcast for that, and it is happening Thursday, the week that we post this, so make sure you get right onto that if you're listening. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing the Tokyo Zodiac Murders by Soji Shimada, and we'll be back with our last chat on that in just a second. This is Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here discussing the Tokyo Zodiac Murders by Soji Shimada, Acts 4 and 5, and the epilogue. Mm-hmm. My goodness, Herds.
What an intricate crime we've had to work with.
Can I have just one moment to gloat before what do you want to gloat about? Into what I did terribly?
What could you possibly have to gloat about?
I was just so happy when I got to the diagram of how the bodies had been rearranged.
Can I tell you, when I asked you last week if you had sought out which body piece was which, I kind of hoped you'd brought in a little piece of paper with a diagram on it. That would have been perfect. But yes, continue.
I just had a list of text for it. That was really great. And I particularly enjoyed the Hail Mary with the handbag.
Yeah, that was the one detail that I wasn't gonna put any points on because I thought it was so far-fetched, but you nailed it. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was one of those things. I wasn't particularly confident about it, but I figured that it was the one thing they discussed that was new information as opposed to what we'd had in the previous act, was that mention of the handbag store. So I was like, this is the only thing I have to go off. The other intermission scene with the police officer was clearly super important, so this must be as well.
Sure.
So I felt good about that, but as with this entire crime, I can't take too much credit for it because, as we've said, I kind of knew what we were getting into from other context of other things I've read.
Yeah. I do want to say, though, I feel like, especially with the sorting of the body parts and the discussion, most of the discussion of, you know, the individual actions of the culprit, you were pretty much spot on. So I think let's start on a positive. You're definitely walking away with at least 2 points today. However, I have one major gripe with you, and let's be clear. I would have said that your answers to my questions last week, the extra questions they gave you, would be enough to make up for this. But I kind of want to put this in your hands because you committed maybe the greatest sin of any murder mystery solver I've ever experienced. Because when I was
so distracted by the locked room that I completely missed that the person who did the crime was the one who found the body.
Yeah,
that
she
is
came
the
in
most basic maneuver in a murder mystery story. Yeah. And I am.
It's not even like, I mean, that is bad, but also the fact that I kind of baited you into this. So I do feel a little bit bad, but we were talking about how, like, you know, the door mechanism's a little complicated. I was like, well, you know, you could like use a hook and string to pull that together. And you were like, yeah, let's go with that. Which is,
that's the game. I cannot sit here. If you don't want to give me that point, I cannot sit here and argue it because that's the whole point of the two of us being here.
The thing is, if you had given any other solution or even failed to respond, I might have solidly given you that point.
Yeah.
But you decided to go with the oldest trick in the book and, in my opinion, one of the worst, which is to thread a piece of string through a window and pull the latch shut.
Yeah.
In my opinion, when you have a solution to a mystery, it should rely on the positions of the characters, right? Yeah. It relies on a character being in the room to lock the door, or the door not being locked at all, or there's a secret passage, or, you know, these sorts of specific ways of getting around the locked room.
Here's the thing that confused me most, though, is that they did bring the rope and string up in the solution.
Kiyoshi says it was probably a hook and string. He doesn't bother, like, explaining it.
I was like, I made the same mistake as Kiyoshi, and I just... I don't understand whether Soji Shimada has done some masterful bait and switch in the same way that you did, admittedly, and managed to trick me into it. Or
I gotta pull the answer. So here's my opinion because we have to get into this. So I think that Kiyoshi has said this to Kazumi because he just doesn't want to think about it anymore. Yeah. It all comes back to what we were talking about.
Yeah.
And the majority of the solution. And so once he'd figured out, oh, this is how it happened. Oh, this poor lady. Oh, this is awful. I hate this. He just didn't want to think about it anymore. That's his kind of reaction.
Okay, so that's all the points out. I think unless you're feeling really generous, Herds, I'm happy to walk away with 2 points from this.
Yeah, I wanted to chat about it with you because I feel kind of dirty, but I think 2 points is more than reasonable for this one.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see if you can make up for it in the next novel. That was good. I really enjoyed chatting about this one. I know you had some misgivings and you hated it and all that. But I
don't lie
goodness,
like that.
I thoroughly enjoyed this novel.
It's so good.
I would read it again in a heartbeat. It's not that long either. It's really not. Let's, what else did you want to chat about?
I kind of wanted to go down this list and look a little bit at how the story implements the rules of Nox.
Okay.
Because I think that it's very intelligent how something we haven't talked about, and I didn't kind of realize until I got to the end, is that the story basically raises the idea of all of Nox's rules indirectly in ways that doesn't actually sound very Noxian. The one that particularly stands out is the fifth one, that no Chinaman or no odd man must figure into the story.
Sure.
I really liked how Hytara factors in on that front because he is the character from a foreign love that Heikichi had. So even though he makes sense in being around the sphere of Heikichi, he's still kind of the odd one out. And it's really interesting how Soji Shimada unpacks that and unravels that, going back to what we were saying about this being deconstructive without feeling it.
Well, it's curious that he's the odd one out in being, you know, from a foreign mother, and also for being the only male child, and thus is, of course, not killed during the murders, which makes him an easy suspect to kind of pick out. But, of course, on the other hand, if you actually look into the way that the, particularly the letter, emphasizes the different characters, he's mentioned, but far more emphasis is placed on the actual culprit, which is something that we've discussed off air a little bit, that there is so much emphasis put on, I have this daughter and I'm very attracted to her because
she looks
like that mannequin, and she's so fly in that new dress that she bought last week from her hospital job that I would not know anything of, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it actually reads a little bit self-indulgent when you know who's actually writing the letter, which is great. but yeah, like, you're absolutely correct in that there are characters who, by the tropes, you would suspect as being the prime suspect.
Yeah.
But if you consider it from the character's perspective, it makes more sense to suspect the actual criminal.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, that clue about the hospital I really like. When we look at the eighth rule, that the detective must not light on any clues.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when we kind of, I guess it kind of applies to the doubles rule, that there must not be twin brothers or doubles generally.
Yeah, unless we're prepared for them. And this is something we discussed in the first part. I asked, you know, what's the point in having the murder suspect have a twin if the twin isn't in some way involved in the murder mystery? And the reason is that it's the idea of a double is setting up the whole concept, as well as the mannequin.
Yeah,
of
a
the concept
identity.
Of switched identities, and of bodies, like, because the bodies are being switched with each other. Like, it's a very indirect way of foreshadowing the way that the six bodies are set up.
And as we were just saying, the fact that the opening note is written by someone pretending to be someone else, it's so clean conceptually.
It all fits together without being very like, I've heard of a case where two bodies were cut in half and they made a third body with the stomach cut out or whatever.
No, I wouldn't say that it broke any of the rules. And that's kind of the really clean thing here, is that this is a great example of a story that has used all of the rules, done them incredibly well, and also kind of poked at the rules in the same way. You know, when we look back at, for example, Naomi Hirahara's Sayonara Slam, that was a really great novel to read, but it wasn't a particularly good mystery, even though it fit out all of the rules. And I think
that's because it didn't really lean on them too hard. Right?
Exactly.
And that's the game, isn't it? That's the game at what we like to call in the business a meta level.
Yeah.
It's incredibly easy to not break Knox's rules if you're not trying to subvert them or play with them in an aggressive way. And that's fine. Novels can do that and still be good stories. But obviously Soji Shimada here is drawing attention to murder mysteries. There's a reason beyond just a joke that he directly, you know, references, you know, all of these different, you know, Western detectives.
Yeah.
And I think he thoroughly excels for the time period that this book was written in, at least, against his contemporaries in just blowing those expectations out of the water.
Well then, Herds.
Flex.
We go from one of the greatest Japanese murder mystery novels of all time.
What are we on? What have you got to top the greatest Japanese murder mystery novel, or one of, at least?
We are going to Masako Togawa's The Master Key.
The Master Key.
This novel, Herds, will be an interesting challenge for you. It's very different from Soji Shimada.
You're scaring me.
I was initially presented this book as a honkaku mystery, which is to say a traditional mystery, which in Japan normally alludes to fair play, at least.
Sure.
I don't agree.
That I'm familiar with. What do you mean? You're giving me a mystery that is not a traditional fair play mystery.
And you're going to prove me wrong.
I'm going to prove you wrong?
That's right, Herds.
That's
the game.
Challenge? I bet you get like 50 bazillion points for this if I could solve them. So you didn't solve this one then. That's what I'm hearing.
I solved this one, but it finagles with the rules in a way that I think are contentious at best.
That doesn't bode well. And we've finagled with some murder mysteries that have tread the line so delicately that we praise them to the high heavens. Is this going to be one of those, this is a problem?
You'll just have to wait and
I'm
see,
scared.
Herds.
I'm
we
scared.
Are doing the prologue and then parts 1 and 2 of the book next week. I'm very excited for this, Herds.
I'm not. I'm scared.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here. This has been Soji Shimada's The Tokyo Zodiac Murders. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you with The Master Key next week on the show. This is 2SER 107.3.